This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen and as ever, I'm sitting in my usual spot in my garden in rural Aberdeenshire and you can hear birds singing in the background. There's a blackbird and sparrows and probably a woodpecker out there somewhere too, the skylarks in the field. And you can hear the hum of bees and the rhododendron off to my right. So it sounds like summer, right? Okay. It's not. It's grey, it's claggy, there's an easterly coming in today, so it's blown the haw straight off the North Sea 5 miles away and covering the fields all round about me. I can't really complain that much because I like the sea. I like the sea a lot. It's one of the things I miss most, I would say, about lockdown. I like the sound of it, I like the smell of it, I like the space of it, and I really do genuinely miss it. With me, about 45 miles to the north, no doubt equally clagged in, Mr. Ewan McElraith.
Yeah, we've got the haar, that kind of moisturising nothingness that comes in off the sea. And certain times it can be quite romantic if you're so disposed, but it's driving me nuts at the moment. 2 weeks ago, we had some wonderful weather on the day that we were released from lockdown to go and enjoy water sports. Spent the whole day getting the sails on the boat ready to go, and then the wind got up and it wheeled round to the north. So I've had 2 weeks now of utter frustration with a boat ready to go, allowed to go out and enjoy water sports, and I haven't had a chance to do it yet. Yeah. It's, you know, it's just so tantalising, it drives you nuts.
I know patience is a virtue, but the fact is you're not terribly virtuous.
No, it's not my strong point, I'll give you that.
Yeah. The sea and sailing is what we're going to be turning our attention to in this edition of the podcast. Philip Marsden is a travel writer and a yachtsman. His latest book, The Summer Isles, charts his journey in his yacht from Cornwall in the southwest of England right up the west coast of Ireland and across to the west coast of Scotland with the ultimate aim of reaching the Summer Isles near Ullapool. Now, it's not just a description of the journey itself. Philip delves really quite deeply into the history, the mythology of the islands he stops at, and it really becomes a voyage of the imagination. I loved it. Philip joins us now from his home in Cornwall. Thanks very much for joining us.
I have to say that I'm slightly the other end of things from you and there, that my boat has engine trouble, so it's sitting there on the mooring, unusable, and the weather is tempting me, but I can't go either.
But it's a great part of the world, because I went to college in Falmouth in Cornwall to do radio journalism, and I was just really, really surprised to open up my eyes about that whole Celtic fringe. I got the Irish and I got the Welsh thing, and I was a latecomer to the party in terms of how important that Celtic heritage is for the folk in Cornwall. You know, there was I can't remember his name now, it was a chap who used to teach at the college who was part of the local radio Celtic language programme. There was a real pride in it. You know, it was hard work, but folk were really excited about it.
Cornwall, Wales, Ireland, west coast of Scotland, Brittany, I mean, they all have this sort of Celtic link. To different people, it means different things. You can link the languages, the history, and just the drama of the landscape. This sort of union of those things was what interested me, both the things that are sort of mythological or fictitious and the things that are actual, like the geology. Well, I've been coming here all my life. I'm from England, as they say here. it's sort of grown in over the decades, and there are more and more bilingual signs in Cornwall. My children were taught a little bit of Cornish in their primary school. 20, 30 years ago, it was just a few people sitting around at a pub talking in Cornish, and it's become much more visible. And I think that is an expression of the distinctiveness of it. And I think both to people who live here, the Cornish, and also to visitors, it adds something to the experience and the interpretation of it being somehow different from the rest of England, and perhaps more in common with those other countries linked by the sea, with Wales, with Brittany, with Ireland and Scotland.
We're going to talk about your journey in a moment, which is fantastic. But you went for a wooden boat. What was the idea behind that? Because I had a wooden folk boat, which a lot of people won't know, but it's a very small boat. I went in to buy a shackle for my mirror dinghy, which was a 14-foot dinghy, and came out with a folk boat, which is a 20-odd-foot wooden boat from the 60s. What did you get, and why did you want to go wood? Because it's hard work.
It's a good question. My first boat was a folk boat, a wooden folk boat. And there's a nice adage that people knock around the bars of yacht clubs down here, is that if you don't like someone, you leave them a boat in your will. But if you really don't like them, you leave them a wooden boat. I think you'd understand what was meant there. They're a lot of work. They go wrong in ways that the plastic fiberglass boats don't go wrong. But I was brought up with wooden boats. I learned to sail with a wooden boat. My grandfather, Scott from Glasgow, for him, boats were wooden. He had various boats, and he always, if one had an engine in it, he would take it out. So we learned to sail, you know, onto the moorings without engines and things. And I apparently sort of earliest sailing experiences was lying in the forepeak of his boat. And there's something about the creak of the timbers and the smell of it, and just that sort of union of natural materials of wood and the shapes that it can give hulls with water and with the sort of the mystique of sailing and using the wind. I mean, you know, one can talk a lot about these sort of things, but actually when it comes down to it, it means that you had to spend a lot of time with sanding down the varnish and dealing with things. I mean, my boat, for instance, was out of the water. It was put in a little bit late this year. And as you'd know, a wooden boat out of the water, and if it's warm at all, will open up, as they say.
And sink.
Anyway, of curing it is by immersing it and letting the water expand the boards again. I spent a night on board, sleeping and pumping out. But those are the sort of things that you suffer for having a wooden boat.
You took the decision to make this journey from Cornwall, heading for the Summer Isles, on your own. Was that something you'd done before?
It wasn't, no. I'd done a bit of cruising, hopping up and down the coast and sailing across the channel, but that was on other people's boats, and it's a big difference between the crew and having your own boat and then being single-handed. I'm a writer who sails rather than a sailor who writes. This was a subject that I was fascinated by, and it combined with a sort of, you know, long love of sailing. But it was conceived in the sort of warmth of libraries and in my own studio with books and charts in a nicely heated room. So that was when I thought, yep, we'll take a boat up to Scotland via Ireland. And being used to sort of travelling on my own and working on my own like that, and the things that happen to you when you're on your own if you're travelling on land, I assumed that I simply just had to transfer that to sea. But sailing single-handed is challenging.
See, it's interesting because unless you have sailed, you don't realise how challenging. There's a quote in your book from Thomas Gibbons, The Explorer, which basically says, "There is but a plank between a sailor and eternity." It's deadly serious. You know, it doesn't take much to go wrong for it to get really quite bad quite quick.
I spent a lot of those months sailing in a state of sort of high anxiety. And I realised that actually that thing of being anxious is really the basis of all good seamanship. If you're not anxious, that's when things start to go wrong. I mean, as always at sea, you have to think sort of two steps away from things that, that might go wrong. But with a if you're single-handed, you have to do that even more because you don't have the liberty of calling on a crew saying, can you just hold that or grab that rope or whatever. You just got to do it all yourself.
We've asked you to choose some particular places along your route to just to focus the discussion more than anything else. But before we get to those, could you just read us a section which describes setting off? Because this really resonated with me.
So what happened, I sailed from Cornwall up to Dingle with one other person. It was it's a sort of three-day, two-night, three-day passage. And I went with someone, and then he left me on my own. Funny enough, I found it quite hard to leave Dingle. It was a lovely place, fantastic people around there, and lots of stories to chase up. But also because it was easy to put off the sort of dreaded moment when I had to throw off the lines and leave the comfort of Dingle Marina and sail up Blasket Sound up towards the west coast. So in the inner harbour, a corridor of buoys led out towards the entrance. Red, green, red, green, red. I passed between them, pointing the bows towards the gap in the cliffs, towards the ruffled water of the open sea. I saw a man with a dog. He was throwing a stick, and I thought, land life, normal life, the ground hard beneath their feet. The bow rose. When there was enough steam room, I brought her up into the wind and freed off the main halyard. Tugging the engine stop, there was a double cough, then silence. Just the wind and the faint swish of the bows. For an hour or so, I sailed west across the sparkling sea, out to the end of the Dingle Peninsula. There was no one else about. And one by one, the worries fell away, and I looked out at the water and the islands, the last fragments of Europe breaking away from the mainland, and was gripped by a sense of freedom so intense that I felt I really could control the 8 tons of wood and iron beneath me.
Going up the west coast of Ireland, I've never sailed it. I've driven down that coastline, and it always struck me as there's nowhere to hide. It's, you know, there's just you and the Atlantic, and going back, you're on your own. It's beautiful, but you, I don't know, are there places to hide if it goes wrong?
I mean, my original plan was not to sail up the west coast. Various friends of mine down here in Cornwall who I talked to, I mean, experienced yachtsmen, they said, look, if you're going to go up to Scotland, yeah, get on the middle bit, up the Irish Sea. And a friend of mine I sailed with a lot, he said he once put his nose out around one of the headlands down in Dingle and was hit by the swell and he just turned round. So I thought, OK, I'll go up to Dingle and I'll go round the south coast and then up the Irish Sea. I'm still not quite sure why I changed my mind, but when I was in Dingle, I just thought I'd give it a go. And actually, the book and the stories I managed to get would never have been possible had I not done that. So What I lost in anxiety and worry, I think the book gains.
What about the islands, though? Because I don't know about you and you know, Mark as well. There is something magical about coming up on a boat to an island, and it's just that wonderful. You know, it's almost like Robert Louis Stevenson's sense of adventure. But there's also that thing where you start imagining seeing it. I was off the coast of Jura last year in a thick mist. And I started seeing islands that weren't there. Have you done that?
That's very much an idea that I was exploring. I mean, I was looking through my photographs on the trip the other day, and there was this one, I mean, quite an ordinary photograph, but just of my weather rail beating out towards Clare Island, and just the angle of the deck and the shape of this sort of the whale back on the horizon. And I thought that's the image that I was thinking of, sailing towards an island. Yeah, there's something about the possibility of islands, this discrete bit of rock in the middle of the ocean, that means you can really sort of put anything on it and imagine as you land there that anything can happen. And the journey is about islands, really. I mean, you know, that coastline, the west coast of Ireland, the west coast of Scotland, is about its islands. And that's so much sort of tied up in and the mythology of it all. All along that coastline and out into the Atlantic, for hundreds of years, it was imagined that, there was islands. In fact, when Columbus sailed for China, he had no idea that America was in the way. He just thought there was a whole lot of islands, and these charts that he took with him just show islands. And there was a place called High Brazil, for instance, which cropped up on charts right up until the middle of the 19th century. And it's entirely made up, a completely fictitious place. And then there was the Tiernanog, the island of the young in Irish mythology. These places which not only sort of didn't exist, but people went off to look for them.
What's really remarkable about that, though, Philip, is that right the way around the world, there's a unifying feature. You know, it's like the old Sunday school song, you know, there is a happy place far, far away. These mythical islands were supposed to be better or more awful or whatever it was. But, you know, the idea of an island paradise is very firmly rooted in sort of human consciousness.
You also get islands of demons, but yes, it's predominantly sort of, as you say, a better place. Perhaps it highlights that we're underneath everything, that we're optimists, and what we don't know, we sort of project good things onto. I mean, those places like Tiernanog and the island Isles of the Blessed were places where fantastic things happened. And the other world is that it was a very prevalent idea in sort of medieval cosmology, the idea of there being a sort of parallel world to this. It manifests itself in lots of ways, but islands were very often the sort of receptacle for these ideas.
And the islands that moved about, there was lots of islands that, you know, they were there one minute and then they were gone the next.
There's an island called Inishbofin off the Connemara coast in Ireland, Island of the White Cow. And the story is that this island used to sort of hover about. If ever you tried to land on it, it would sort of slip away over the horizon or vanish into the fog. And one day some fishermen actually did manage to land on it, and they lit a fire, and the fire sort of fixed the island. And as they lit it, they saw a woman beating a white cow, and they reprimanded her because cows are sort of sacred, and they all turned to stone. But that's how this very real island, Inishbofin, came into existence. And that sort of that ambiguity, I mean, as you were saying earlier on, the thing of looking out to sea, and it could be a fog bank, it could be an island, it could be clouds. You can see quite easily how those sort of ideas and stories emerged.
But that whole folklore of the islands is just so captivating. And presumably as you went further up the west coast of Ireland, you're delving into places that very few folk have been to. This is a remote part of Europe.
Well, it is, but I mean, like the west coast of Scotland and the islands, the Hebridean Islands. I mean, they were much more populated until the middle of the 20th century. You look back at the records of population in the 19th century, after sort of famine and things, life was easier on there than on the mainland. So a lot of the islands were inhabited, and very typical of west coast islands in Ireland, as in Scotland, to sort of land on uninhabited places and find those remains of cottages and communities that were there. It's sort of haunted, and not only sort of more recent communities, but monastic communities from the past. So you get these layers of sort of habitation and occupation.
I have to say I was sadly ignorant of how rich the vein of literature was across in the west coast of Ireland particularly. Somebody told me quite recently that one in five people in Iceland has published a book. And I don't know whether that's true or not. If it's true, it's absolutely extraordinary. But that, you know, that there is a place, Great Blasket, that can knock that into a cocked hat.
So the Blasket off the Dingle Peninsula was home to about, well, there were 22 households in the 1920s. But out of this small community emerged a fantastic body of Irish literature. They were known for their storytelling and the particular variety of Irish that they spoke. And they were encouraged to write sort of autobiographies. And it started off with Thomas O'Cron, with The Island Man. And he was encouraged to write that, and it was translated into English. And it became hugely popular around the place. And so others thought they'd have a go as well. And, I mean, there are any number of books about them. There's just something about the idiomatic nature of Irish and just the lilt of it, which comes through even in English. And they had that, and the stories that just the stories of island life has that sort of wonderful charm and sort of humour and depth to it, as well as this sort of slight hovering world of the other world and the real world, this sort of ambiguity as well.
There is another incredibly rich vein of nature poetry that I was unaware of. That it's It is elegantly sparse. I mean, you describe it as being a bit like Celtic haiku.
Yes, this is a tradition of Celtic nature poetry, written in Irish and Welsh particularly, from very early. And like all the early literature, we only have what survives and what wasn't destroyed by the Vikings. I've always been very, very fond of these poems. And here's a little passage about them with some examples. The poems were the work of Irish monks, part Christian in spirit and part pagan, who pursued their devotions in the remotest of places, like here on Inishdooey off the northwest coast of Ireland. Some of the works were formal or merged into longer cycles of story. Others were more direct, simple observations, for instance, of the sounds heard outside a hermit's hut. The voice of the wind against the branchy wood, grey with cloud, cascades of the river, the swan's song, lovely music. And then describing summer. The smooth sea flows, season when the ocean falls asleep. Flowers cover the world.
That one line, the season when the sea falls asleep, it's just perfect.
You had a bit of a numbing moment off Islay. Because the weather can change so quickly in that part of the world.
I'd crossed from Ireland and been holed up in Port Ellen for a week or more, actually, because of gales. And again, it's been quite reluctant to stick my nose out and having plenty to explore on Islay. And when I did leave, it was a, sort of the tail end of this weather. A mile or two out of Port Ellen, a squall hit me with such ferocity that I lost my nerve. I'd intended to head northwest, squeezing through the Sound of Islay, anchoring for the night in Loch Tarbert on the west coast of Jura, before pushing on up towards Oban. It was exposed and remote. Plan B was a much easier route up the eastern shore of Jura. So, Plan B. The squall had come up astern, a curtain of rain with a hem of spray sweeping across the water. In the moment before it reached the boat, a hiss. Then, frantic flapping, a 50-degree wind shift, downdrafts, and a jibe which might have been catastrophic had I not had the mainsheet in tight. I'd been watching the shoreline of Islay and the island of Texa and the distillery Lagavulin writ large on the side of the maltings. Now that all vanished. First behind bars of rain, then inside a featureless maelstrom of wet cloud. The boat was racing blind. I was heading too far to the north, but could do little about it. Rain was pouring down my face. I couldn't wipe my eyes as I had the Genoa sheet in one hand with a couple of turns around the winch and the main sheet in the other, and the helm between my legs. I felt I was playing some crazed colt on a lunging rein. For 5 minutes, the squall continued. Then it eased. The rain was running off the boom and the noise was falling away. I cleated the Genoa on the main and was checking for damage when it came again. A single blast of wind. The boat stumbled, dipping the lee rail. I had to free the sails fast to avoid us being knocked down. But that was all. It was over. The wind dropped, the sun came out, the water sparkled, and I pointed the bows back towards MacArthur's Head and the Sound of Islay. I forgot about Plan B. Such are the fickle extremes of single-handed problems.
it's really moving me that bit, because I was in a gale in the thickest fog I've ever been in my life, going from Jura up towards Oban, and I could not see a hand in front of my face. And then suddenly, on the radar, you could see a big boat coming at me, 30 knots. And I panicked and radioed, said, more or less, a big boat north of Latin Longitude, can you see me on your radar? And the Calmac ferry clansman came back, yes, I can see you, you're all right. And it passed within about 100 yards of me, but just out of nowhere. And at that point, you think, why do you want to sail? And as you say, the sun comes out, the world's a happy place, and let's go sailing again.
Yeah, it is. It is that sort of extreme. I think if you're that temperament who enjoys the extremes, then you'll probably like sailing. I think fog more than wind is the sort of greatest fear of the yachtsman. What I found about one's anxiety in sailing was that the worst time was before leaving. Actually, the worst time was when you were sort of standing at the harbour or on board, looking at the weather the final time, thinking, shall I go? Shan't I? You know, what is this place I'm going to like next? What's the weather like? You know, do I know? And those times when you can make the decision of not to go were the most anxious. And I found that when you're at sea, you kind of dealt with things. They happened, and they always did happen. Things did go wrong. And you just sort of got through it. I mean, it wasn't any less alarming, but somehow it didn't have that intense anxiety of sort of anticipation and waiting and still having the decision to sort of not go to sea.
Quite early on in your trip, you're sailing with a guy called, I think it's Ian, and he came up with an expression, and I actually laughed out loud when I read it, because Ewan and I have worked together for many, many years, and I know that he is possibly the least patient person on the planet. What Ian said was that a patient sailor will always have kind winds. You know, if you're prepared to wait, but sometimes you have to wait a long time.
That is the thing, and often one gets impatient and puts to sea too early. But that is that's one of those statements that sort of haunts you as well when you're trying to make decisions. But if you wait another, you know, you'll be certain after another couple of days. If you slip into that mentality, you're never going to leave port.
You went over from the north of Ireland to Islay, up past Jura and the Corryvreckan whirlpool. What was that like? I mean, if you get the Corryvreckan wrong, you're in big trouble.
Anyone who knows those waters knows Corryvreckan is a sort of, you know, the big daddy of all marine risks. And I went up the west coast of Jura. I spent a fantastic night anchored in Loch Tarbert there. It just feels wonderfully remote with the seals moaning on the rocks all night. And then headed up towards Oban. And I got caught in the edge of it. I mean, it moves around. It was just one of those conditions where it had shifted a bit. And I'd been in tide races around Ireland and also the south coast of England before. So I know that you get a bit of smooth water first, which is a sort of the calm before the storm. And then you have these extraordinary sort of seas which have no shape to them. And you sort of fall off them and get battered by them. And you just have to drive through it. So I was actually looking through binoculars at this wonderful sight of the seabirds feeding where it was at its most intense, and it's kicking up all these sort of sand eels and things. And you could see these gannets and gulls, guillemots and things feeding intensely at this place. And I was sort of, you know, nicely thinking, well, I can see it through binoculars. And then suddenly I was in that smooth bit of water, and it shifts around. And then there was 10, 15 minutes of chaos, but we got through it. But it was, it was just a little taste of what Corryvreckan can be like.
The island of Canna. We've both been to Canna too. And it's just one of those very strange, very old places.
It's a beautiful place. I mean, it's unlike a lot of the Hebrides in that it's green and very fertile. One of the interesting things about it, I've heard, is that there's a great deal of unexplored archaeology on it, unexcavated sites and things. And the suggestion is that if you look at it on the charts of the Hebrides, it's sort of right in the middle. There is a sort of fertile, hospitable place right in the middle, and probably at the hub of all the seaways that ran around the Hebrides. So it's always had a kind of special feeling to it. And I've been there years before and met Margaret Fay Shaw, who lived there with her husband, John Long Campbell, since just before the war. And it was one of the places that I wanted, you know, really did want to get to. She died some years ago, but I just wanted to go back and revisit and find out what happened to Canna House, where they lived, and their archive there. She was American. I mean, she's an amazing, amazing woman, really extraordinary. And she came from the States and then wanted to be a concert pianist, actually, and trained and was studying, and then got an infection in her hands and was told she would never play professionally. And the doctor said, "What will you do?" And she said, "I will go to the islands of Scotland and collect song." And it's exactly what she did. She lived in a black house on South Uist for many years, learnt Gaelic, collected song and stories. And at one point, an uncle in the States, feeling a bit sorry for her, sent her some money to get some warm clothes or to do something.
Essentials, I think he said.
But what she did was order a baby Steinway piano from Glasgow, and got a fisherman to go down, and they went down to collect it and bought the Steinway to, well, then it was South Uist in a sort of corrugated house that she lived in with her husband then. And then it went with her to Canna, and it's still there in her sitting room. And I remember her playing it and playing Chopin and singing and smoking the whole time.
A lot of these islands that you write about, Philip, I think it's Robert McFarlane talks about, you know, places around the world where he describes them as thin places. You know, the divide between, you know, the spiritual world and, the, you know, what you might describe as the real world, the actual world, the physical world, is very, very thin. You seem to encounter a lot of that.
Because it's there. I mean, that sense is, I mean, I was looking for it. It's one of the things that appealed to me. The sense of the other world and the closeness of a sort of parallel world and a world which is imagined and the world which is projected upon. That's somehow the west coast of Scotland, the west coast of Ireland and these sort of Celtic fringes. But for whatever reason, in both Ireland and Gaelic Scotland, you have this huge tradition of the fairy world, the Sidhe. It's sort of emblematic, I think, of the way that we perhaps we're sort of not so connected in any way, actually, as we used to be. The way that we live in the real world, but there's this world just outside, and certain places enable you to sort of access it. Often it's threatening. I mean, there are lots of stories about people being stolen into the other world. So it just has that imaginary sense, and that was one of the things I wanted to explore.
But that's the joy of sailing single-handed. You can just let your imagination flow.
That's what I'd hoped. When I was sitting in my nice warm studio, sort of imagining this, researching it, that's what I imagined, that exactly that, yeah, I'd sail into a lovely anchorage and put down the anchor and then spend the time sort of reading and contemplating. But what I found was that actually 90% of the time you got into an anchorage and then there were about three or four things that had gone wrong when you'd been at sea and you had to fix and you had to check this and check that. So one of the sort of realities about single-handed sailing is that you don't have as much time for contemplation as I'd hoped. But having said that, because I was in such a sort of heightened state of alertness, actually when those moments did come, they were that much more intense. So it sort of worked both ways. And I think just that thing of being on your own, being hyper sort of alert to every movement of the sea, every movement of the weather, made one also alert to sort of the suggestions and the sort of imaginary suggestions of those places as well.
During the lockdown, I've been doing a lot of research into the folklore of birds. I mean, I've been looking at the folklore of birds and animals all my life. But in recent weeks, I've noticed a lot of these stories seem to be appealing to more folk than ever. I mean, is that just my imagination, or is there a general heightened awareness of the folklore, the mythology, the traditions that we have?
That's interesting. I mean, you know, like all of us, I've had a lot of conversations with people in the last couple of months, and the things that they've mentioned that are different. And, you know, one of the things is dreams, and people have been having really intense dreams, it seems. Another thing is the spring. A lot of people who haven't been aware in the same way are suddenly aware of spring in a sort of really intense and rather kind of life-changing way, which is wonderful. I think also that it's, yes, I mean, it's interesting you say that about folklore, because I think that actually the sort of quietening down of things and the way that we've had to slow down and lock into a sort of daily rhythm of repeated things has opened up the imagination and perhaps sort of re-exposed ourselves to ways of thinking that we've lost when we sort of rush around and jump on trains and jump in cars and go hither and thither. That we're sort of rediscovering perhaps that that layer of the imagination that used to be quite normal. You know, I think being alert to those stories, I mean, as you say, the folklore of birds, I mean, that's exactly the sort of thing of spending time outside, seeing the birds, hearing hearing their song, and having that time to sort of think about it and to sort of think about meanings attached to it. I think that's, after all, that's where folklore comes from. And perhaps in our sort of crazy pre-lockdown lives, we were not so attuned to that as we are now in confinement.
Could we just go back briefly to this idea of thin places? Because I know you have travelled extensively around the world as a writer, and you've been to some very exotic places. Where else have you found those thin places?
The great love of my sort of travelling life and where I first was exposed to sort of that kind of travel was Ethiopia. And I think the Ethiopian highlands, geographically, they have these features. I mean, it's very high. It's a sort of plateau about 9,000 feet above sea level. And you get these places where the rivers have dug deep gorges, and you get sort of islands of rock, often flat-topped. And sometimes they're sort of sheer cliffs all the way around, and the only way up them is sort of with ropes and things. But on top of them, there's a whole series of monasteries and monastic communities that lived there. And I think that in terms of physical and the ethereal and the imaginative, like the islands of the west coast of Ireland and Scotland, they have that sense of being removed from the rest of the world and have that reward of visiting. The parallels with islands in the Western Ocean are obvious. They've been holy places, just like the Western Isles, where monks went to sort of live in isolation. So these islands in the sky in Ethiopia have the same sort of thing. But I do think, actually, of all the places I've been to, I mean, these islands off Ireland, off Scotland, are the thinnest, if you like, in those terms, the sort of most liminal, the most evocative of anywhere I've been.
Tying together what you've just said and what Ewan was asking you about as well, the monastic approach to life, you know, it's not a removal from temptation, the ascetic approach. It's, to my mind, it's a chance to get away from the noise and actually hear the sound. You know, to understand the significance of things, the meaning of things, to strip things down. And you get the chance to do that in some of these Western islands.
Exactly. It's no coincidence that they were chosen by monks to isolate themselves. And I think also just that thing of contemplation, the Celtic nature poems, you know, were written largely by monks. And a lot of them are just about sitting still, letting the sounds come to you, letting those observations just assemble themselves into a wonderful and beautiful sort of encapsulation of where you are. And that's obviously much easier on an island, on a remote island, than it is surrounded by all sorts of traffic noise and city things. So yes, I think they still have that capacity to offer contemplation in that way.
Philip, I've really enjoyed chatting to you. Thank you so much for your time. Philip Marsden's excellent book, The Summer Isles, A Voyage of the Imagination, is out now and published by Granta. It is a really fascinating read. Please get in touch with us and tell us what you think of this podcast, or if you have any suggestions for guests. If you've got time, like us or refer us to a friend. You know, the more the merrier. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. From myself, Mark Stephen, Ewan McElraith, and producer Helen Needham, thank you very much for listening.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.